smell, and instead it had a nice oaky aroma. Similar to the way Lawrence imagined the whiskey casks would be before you put scotch into them for aging, this was a place where you would age well. There was some debate over whether they would go out for dinner, everybody except Ernesto, that is, or just bring in food. "Maybe we could check out that new hipster tapas place," suggested Patricia.
"Tapas?"
Dorothea, the elderly lady, clapped her hands, so her bracelets rang. The person of unknown gender, whose name rather unhelpfully was Taylor, said perhaps Lawrence would be more comfortable on neutral ground.
"Yes, yes, you must go,"
Ernesto said in his gravelly voice with a hint of a Latin accent.
"Go. Do not worry about me at all."
In the end, Ernesto insisted so loudly that they simply must leave him behind, everybody wound up offering to stay in with him. Lawrence couldn't help wondering if he'd just witnessed a wizard duel. Somehow, they managed to catch the Korean taco truck driving from one location to another and bought a dozen spicy bulgogi and barbecue tofu tacos while it was stopped at a red light. Lawrence's taco had a lot of cilantro and onions, the way he secretly liked it. His anxiety melted away, and he envied Patricia for having such charming friends. If this had been a gathering of Lawrence's tribe, by now someone would already have tried to prove they were the supreme expert on some topic. There would have been dick measuring. Instead, these people just seemed to accept one another and feed each other tacos. They all got seats on folding chairs, or the handful of actual armchairs in the bookstore. Lawrence wound up sitting between Taylor, the young person of indeterminate gender, and Dorothea, the lady of indeterminate age. Dorothea smiled and leaned over as Lawrence chewed his taco.
"I once owned a restaurant that had doorways in a dozen cities around the world," she whispered. "Each entrance wore a different menu, advertising a different cuisine, but we had no kitchen, just tables, tablecloths, and chairs. We carried the dishes back and forth between the cities in different lands. So were we a restaurant or a conduit?"
Lawrence wasn't sure if she was telling a real story or just taking the piss, or both. He stared, and all at once her face was full of laugh lines. After dinner, Ernesto sauntered to a bookcase labeled Parties That Already Ended, which was mainly histories of various empires. He removed a Decline and Fall with a flourish, and the bookcase swung open, revealing a passageway leading to a secret bar, with a neon fairy on the wall and a sign proclaiming it to be the Green Wing. The Green Wing was another oblong, spacious room like Danger Books, but this one was dominated by a circular wooden bar in the center of the room with a single rack full of absinthe. Art Nouveau maidens and crystal dragons and parchment scripts adorned the bottles, which were every size and shape. A few people wearing corsets and poofy skirts were already drinking at a high table in the far corner, but they all waved at Ernesto. Ernesto climbed inside the bar and started pouring from bottles into shakers. Patricia got next to Lawrence long enough to whisper in his ear that he should be careful with any drink made or touched by Ernesto.
"Take small sips," she advised, "if you plan on having a brain tomorrow."
None of these people seemed to be super influential, and if they ruled the world, they were doing a good job of hiding it. In fact, every other conversation was about how messed up the world was and how they wished things could be different. Ernesto mixed Lawrence something bright green that captured the neon light, and he caught Patricia's warning gaze before lifting it to his mouth. It smelled so delicious. He had to make a mighty effort to avoid pouring it through his lips. His mouth was full of wonder and joy, and there were so many sharp and sweet and bright flavors that that he needed to keep sipping to identify half of them. Lawrence was legless. He stumbled until someone helped him into a brocaded 18th-century chair that he couldn't find his way out of again. He realized that this was a perfect opportunity to ask some questions about magic, since nobody could blame the drunk guy for being nosy. Right? He raised his head and looked into the swarm of blurry shapes and lights and strained to form a not-too-rude question. He was unable to find a verb to save his life, or a noun.
"It has been a pleasure to meet you, Lawrence,"
Ernesto said, pulling a stool close to Lawrence's face so that his eyeliner and unpinned long gray hair were in something like focus. He had lowered his voice to a conversational tone, but it still sounded theatrical, every word enunciated, like a stage actor's diction. Ernesto was close enough for Lawrence to catch the scent of an entire meadow pollinating coming off him. Close enough that if Lawrence toppled forward, he would be touching Patricia's mentor, which Patricia had said would be very bad. Ernesto leaned closer, and Lawrence shrank back.
"I must ask you a question or two,"
Ernesto said between sips from a martini glass,
"about your intentions toward Patricia. She has confided in you, and we approve, because everybody needs a confidant. But you must promise us to tell nobody else about the things she shares with you. Not your lover, Serafina, not your friend, Isabel. And certainly not your patron, Milton. Can you make such a promise?"
Lawrence said. "Yes. Yes, I can."
"Will you humor me and swear to it? That if you break your promise, you will never speak another word again. To anyone."
Ernesto laughed and waved one hand, as if this were a mere formality. But in the background, Lawrence saw Patricia shaking her head, her eyes wide with panic.
Sure, Lawrence said. I promise. And if I ever say anything about magic to anyone, I hope I lose my voice. Forever.
Ernesto shrugged, as if mentioning a minor detail.
Forever, said Lawrence.
There's just one other favor we wanted to ask, said the Japanese guy, Kawashima, coming into focus next to Ernesto.
They were almost touching.
We worry a lot about Patricia, you see. She went through a lot when she was younger. First that Theodolphus douchebag, and then later that regrettable business in Siberia.
I hate it when you talk about me in the third person when I'm in the room, Patricia said. Not to mention the way you're railroading my friend here.
We want you to help us look out for her, Kawashima said to Lawrence. We have few rules, but our biggest taboo is against what we call aggrandizement, making yourself into a big deal. So we want you to support her and be her friend in a way that none of us can. And yet also to remind her that she is just a person, just like anyone else, if she gets too high an opinion of herself.
Will you do this for her and for us?
Ernesto said.
Lawrence thought for a moment they were going to ask him to agree that his hands would turn into fins if he didn't help keep Patricia's ego under control. But for this promise, just a vague,
"I'll do my best,"
seemed to suffice. Kawashima slapped him on the shoulder, and everybody repeated a few times how nice it had been to meet him. Lawrence felt his gorge rising. Someone guided him to a small toilet in the far corner of the absinthe bar, and he crouched over it for a good 15 minutes until his stomach was empty. Taylor and Patricia took Lawrence for vegan donuts over on Valencia Street. His head was split in half, and he was seeing spots. Taylor whispered something in Lawrence's ear, and he felt a bit more even keel. Plus, coffee and ibuprofen helped, too.
You did good, Taylor told him. You were in the frickin' lion's den. And you were as cool as cream cheese.
It just pisses me off, Patricia said. They think I'm some kind of egomaniac when all I want to do is make croissants and get on with my life. And they can't just ask Lawrence to keep his trap shut without putting a spell on him. The full weight of it hit Lawrence then. They'd put a spell on him. A curse, really. If he spoke a word about magic or magicians to anybody, he would never speak again. He knew in his sore guts that this was a fact. Of course, there was no way to test, except the hard way. He stared at his thumbs, pivoting on the oaken table. What if he had to text people instead of talking to them for the rest of his life? It's not like that, Taylor said to Patricia. You should be grateful that you have people worrying about you. Ever since you moved here to Succafree, you've been overcompensating. I feel bad about Siberia, too, but we have to move on.
Okay, Lawrence said. So now I am apparently under a...
He looked around the coffee place twice, trying to figure out if anyone was within earshot.
I am going to be facing certain constraints about what I can say to people who weren't in that bookstore tonight. So that means you can explain to me, right? You can tell me how this works. I'm just curious, is all.
Sounds fair. Taylor handed him a second donut. Yeah, okay, Patricia said. But not here. Maybe this weekend we can go for a walk in the park. I remember how much you like the outdoors.
Lawrence shuddered, which was probably a sign that he was starting to feel like himself again.
Chapter 20. Patricia felt jittery about throwing her first ever dinner party, because part of her clung to the fantasy of being someone who gathered cool people around her, a doyenne, someone who held witty salons. She cleaned the apartment for hours, made a playlist, and baked bread and bundt cake. Her roommates, Dee Dee and Racheline, made their famous passive-aggressive lasagna, and Taylor showed up with shiny pants and a bowl of mixed greens. Kevin arrived in a deep cerulean waistcoat that matched the ribbon tying back his dreads, and he had brought weird cheeses. Patricia's bread filled the marigold kitchenette with a yeasty warmth, and she took a deep breath. She was a grown-up. She had this. While Patricia served the salad, Kevin told Dee Dee and Racheline about the psychology of dog walking. Some of the times Kevin had tried to sneak out after sleeping with Patricia, he'd run into her roommates still half awake on the couch. They'd started calling him Mr. No Overnight, although not to his face. Dee Dee was talking about her ska band's latest gig, in which, as usual, the blue-haired, wiry singer exuded so much raw Kathleen Hanna-esque sexuality, nobody would ever guess that she identified as asexual. Just as Patricia was fetching the bread, Taylor glanced around and said this was a nice apartment. Too bad Patricia might have to move to Portland soon.
What?
Patricia dropped her mitt on the floor. She was standing by the open oven, so she felt frozen on one side and red-hot on the other.
Oh. Taylor leaned back, hands raised. I thought you knew. They're thinking of sending you to Portland.
Who is they?
Kevin blinked.
Forget I said anything. I was talking out of school.
Taylor's smile had vanished, replaced with wide eyes and a clenched jaw. This was so like Taylor. They were so closed off, you could barely tell what they were thinking most of the time. But then they would toss out these bombs just to see everyone jump. Patricia seized the bread with her bare hands, let it burn her.
This is bullshit. They can't make me move to Portland.
In Portland, all the young witches lived in one group house, with a curfew, and a few older witches supervised them.
When were you going to tell me you were moving to Portland?
Kevin said. I'm not, Patricia said, choking and coughing.
Who's making you move?
Dee Dee asked from the sofa, pierced eyebrows raised.
I don't get it.
Please forget I said anything.
Taylor was squirming now. Let's just eat. Everybody stared at their plates and each other, but nobody said anything, until Racheline broke the silence.
Actually, I think you had better explain, said Racheline, who was older than everyone else and the master tenant on the apartment. Who are these people, and why are they forcing Patricia to move?
Racheline was a quiet woman, a perennial grad student with wild red hair and a placid round face, but when she decided to assert herself, everybody snapped to attention. Everybody stared at Taylor, including Patricia.
I'm not allowed to say, Taylor stammered. Let's just say Patricia and I both have the same caseworker, and everybody worries about her. Like, she goes off on her own for days. She tries to take everything on herself, and she doesn't let anyone help her. She needs to let other people in.
I let people in.
Patricia felt bloodless. Her ears were ringing.
Right now, this moment, I am interacting with people.
She should have known.
It's true, though,
Dee Dee said.
Patricia, we never see you. You live here, but you're never home. You never want to tell us anything about your life. You've been here nearly a year, but I feel like I don't know you at all.
Patricia tried to catch Kevin's eye, but it was like lassoing a hummingbird. She was still holding the bread, and it was burning her hands.
I'm really trying. Look at me trying right this moment. I'm having a party.
She heard her timbre rising until she sounded like her mother. Red haze blinding her.
Why did you have to ruin this for me?
She threw chunks of bread at Taylor, who covered their face.
Do you want some bread? Do you want some bread? Have some fucking bread!
Now she sounded exactly like her mom. She threw away the rest of the bread and bailed out of there, crying and spitting on the dry sidewalk. Patricia had fallen in love with Danger Bookstore on her first ever visit, and whenever she climbed the wooden staircase, she usually felt a little of the packing tape around her soul unwind. But this time, she just felt the stabbing in her neck get worse as she reached the top floor with its unsafe railing and threadbare purple carpet. Ernesto sat in his usual chair, eating a microwaved TV dinner. He was in love with the invention of the microwave, both because it fit in with his love of instant gratification, the lineaments of gratified desire, and because you couldn't leave food near him for more than a few minutes before it grew spiky white mold. He wore a silk robe, emerald pajamas, and fuzzy slippers, with William Blake's poems perched on one knee.
What the hell?
Patricia said before Ernesto could greet her.
When were you going to tell me about this plan to send me to Portland?
She almost knocked over the bookcase of Ideas Too Good to Be True.
Please sit.
Ernesto gestured at a clamshell armchair. Patricia tried to rebel for a moment, then gave up and sat.
We do not wish to send you away, but we have spoken about it. You make it difficult for us to watch over you. People want to care about you, and you will not let them.
I've been trying.
She shuffled in her chair. This was the worst day.
I've tried and tried. Everybody gives me grief about aggrandizement, but I've tried so hard. I've been so careful.
You are hearing the wrong thing.
Ernesto rose and stood close to her so she could feel his unnatural warmth.
People warn you about aggrandizement, and you keep hearing the opposite of what they are saying.
Nobody knew why Ernesto was the way he was, but there were rumors. Like he'd cast a huge spell that had backfired. Or there'd been an endangered species, a rhino or something, and all the surviving animals had poured their life essence into one massive creature, which swelled with the lost potential of future generations. Maybe this towering gestalt stomped across the countryside, and everything it touched rotted. Blood bubbled from its eyes, ears, and stumpy toes, and it gave off an overripe stench. The creature, the story went, threatened a town full of innocent people until Ernesto took on its burden of excess life. Ernesto was so old, he'd gone to school back when El Tisley Academy and the Maze were still two separate schools. "Everybody thinks Siberia was my fault," Patricia said, "because I was too proud or whatever, too reckless." In her mind, Patricia saw before and after images of Toby, first alive, then dead, like a gif from hell. "They think I'm still too arrogant now. I'm just trying to help."
"Listen harder,"
Ernesto said. Most of the time, the thick eyeliner made his eyes appear lively, unfocused. But now, he seemed to see into the grungiest corners of Patricia's psyche. Ernesto went back to his chaise, and Patricia was left trying to figure this out. It was one of those annoying tests, both a dirty trick and a healing exercise. She was pretty sure she'd been listening just fine. She was ready to throw foodstuffs again. "Fine," Patricia said after she decided she wasn't going to crack this tonight. "I will listen harder, and I will try to be less self-absorbed and more humble. I will let people in, if anybody even wants to be my friend after tonight."
"I spent 30 bitter years trying to find a way to leave this place,"
Ernesto said so quietly she had to lean perilously close. He gestured at the room full of books, with his eyes.
"Until at last, I accepted that this imprisonment was a price that I had chosen to pay. Now I enjoy my situation as much as I can. But you have not yet begun to experience the pain of being a witch. The mistakes, all the regrets. The only thing that will make such power bearable is to remember how small you are."
He went back to William Blake, and Patricia couldn't tell if this meant their conversation was over. "So does this mean I'm not going to Portland?"
"Listen harder," was all Ernesto said from behind the book. "We do not want to send you away. Do not make us."
"Okay." Patricia still felt raw and desperate inside. She realized she ought to leave before Ernesto offered to make her a cocktail next door, because she didn't want to get falling upwards drunk right now. As soon as she got out of danger, she saw her phone was full of texts and voicemails. She called Kevin, who was worried, and she was like, "I'm fine, except I need a drink." Half an hour later, she leaned on Kevin's crushed velvet frock coat and pounded a Corona in the swampy back room of the art bar on 16th, with fresh graffiti on the wall and a DJ spinning classic hip-hop. Kevin was drinking Pimm's with a fat cucumber slice and not asking her what the scene at dinner had been about. He looked amazing in the bar's golden light, sideburns setting off the smooth planes of his face. "I'm fine," Patricia kept saying. I'm sorry you had to see that. I'm fine. I sorted it out. But as her tongue greeted the lime wedge bobbing up to the lip of the bottle and tasted the pulp mixed with beer, she remembered how Kevin wouldn't even look her in the eye when everybody else was accusing her of being a toxic loner.
We should talk about what this is, right? You and me.
What we're doing. She started to say, trying to make herself heard over the DJ without shouting,
I feel like we tried too hard not to label our relationship, and that became a label in itself.
I have something I have to tell you, Kevin said, his eyes bigger and sadder than usual.
I'm ready to open up about my feelings. I feel...
Patricia searched for the right words.
I feel good about us. I care about you a lot, and I am open to...
I met someone else, Kevin blurted. Her name is Mara. She's also a webcomics artist of some renown. She lives in the East Bay. We met only in the past fortnight, but this already shows signs of becoming serious. I wasn't even looking, but my caddy pinged me with 29 points of convergence between Mara and myself. He gazed into his PIMS. You and I never said we were exclusive, or even that we were dating. Patricia chewed her thumb, a habit she'd quit years ago.
I'm happy, happy, for you. I'm happy for you.
Patricia. Kevin took both her hands. You are utterly mad, but delightful. I feel so overjoyed to have gotten to know you. But I have been a fool too many times already, and I tried, I really did, to talk to you about our relationship on 5 separate occasions, in the park when we were roller skating, and also at that pizza bar. As Kevin listed these moments, she could see them with perfect clarity, all the missed cues and deflections, all the abortive moments of intimacy. All this time she had been thinking of him as the one with commitment issues. Somewhere along the line, she had become an asshole.
Thank you for being honest with me, Patricia said.
She sat and finished her drink until it was just lime rind and bitter pulp. Patricia wound up in Dolores Park at midnight. The heat still felt as intense as direct sunlight, and her mouth was dry. She couldn't go home and face Dee Dee and Racheline. For some reason, Patricia found herself calling her sister, Roberta, whom she hadn't talked to in months, although she'd had a couple conversations about Roberta with her parents.
Hey, Bert.
Hi, Trish. How is everything going?
I'm okay.
Patricia took a breath, which came out staccato. She stared at the playground rocket ship and the Victorian houses with their pregnant windows.
I'm sort of okay. I just...
Do you ever feel like you're just throwing away the people in your life? Like being so self-centered that people just fall away?
Roberta laughed. I have the opposite problem. I have a hard time disposing of the bodies. Ha ha. Trish, listen to me for once in your life. I know we never got along, and I was partway responsible for you running away from home. But one thing I know about you is, you're a generous person. You're a big bleeding heart. People have fucked with you, including me. Especially me. So you have a lot of defense mechanisms. But you always put yourself on the line for other people. You don't push people away. You try to do everything for people, and then they don't get to do anything for you. Please don't let any idiots tell you otherwise, okay?
Patricia was bawling, even worse than before, right there in the park. She felt it pour down her face, and she was full of a sense that everything was broken and full of sweetness. She had never realized her sister thought that way about her.
If anybody tries to tell you that you're selfish, Roberta said, send them to me, and I'll snap their necks for you, okay?
Okay, Patricia stammered. They talked a bit more, about Roberta's musical theater disasters and her latest attempt to go straight edge, and then at last Patricia felt ready to go home and face her roommates, who were on the couch, like always. They slid over, without comment, to let Patricia watch TV with them. Patricia had another one of her dreams about being lost in the woods, this time running with a pack of deer. A barbarian yell in her throat and the scent of tree sap in her nostrils. She ran with her elbows and her stomach and her knees until she couldn't breathe. Patricia stumbled and fell onto her hands, gasping, laughing. She looked up and there was that big bird-shaped tree again, with the mindful gaze coming through its branches. Patricia walked up and touched it with her palms against its ropey bark, feeling the power rising and churning inside of it. Touching that weird tree from her childhood fancies, Patricia felt as though she could heal an entire army with a single breath. Air rushed through the tree, like it was drawing breath to speak to her in its stentorian whoosh. Then she woke up. She'd overslept, in spite of her alarm. Patricia was fixing Reginald's sink, which had one of those glitchy new valves that were supposed to shut off the water after a couple minutes, and she found herself talking about her breakup with Kevin. I mean, I guess it's for the best, since it was never going to work, but it's a symptom of the larger problem that I never have time for anybody, and I keep isolating myself, and I'm basically doomed to wind up alone forever, right? She expected Reginald to offer some bromides about how she just needed to be herself, but instead he said, "Get a caddy." What? She nearly bonked her head on the sink. Get a caddy. It will change your life. I'm not kidding. At all. You become totally connected to all the people in your life. Not like regular social networking either. It's uncanny. You will just run into people you know, in person, when you most need to see them. I could barely afford one on my fixed income, but it turned out to be the best investment I ever made. I always thought they were just for mission hipsters, Patricia said. Anyway, it sounds creepy. Seriously, no. It's not creepy, and it's so easy to use. It doesn't spy on you or tell you to stalk your friends. I've never felt like it was invading my privacy. It just makes serendipity happen more often. It's unobtrusive and doesn't give you a bunch of alerts, but you'll always know what's the one party you shouldn't miss. I was feeling isolated, even with your much-appreciated visits. And then I got this caddy, and I feel as though I'm back in my own life again. In spite of Reginald's insistence that the caddy wasn't at all creepy, his hard sell was in itself kind of creepy. He sounded like someone who had just joined a cult. Patricia vowed that she would never, ever buy a caddy. Ever. 2 days later, Patricia was in the caddy store near Union Square. It was narrow, with curving walls that drew you toward the counter at the back, like a stream curving around some rocks. The walls seemed to glow. Patricia picked up a caddy from the display on one wall, and the screen flared to life. There was a swirl of colors, and then it resolved into a wheel shape. The wheel had swirls coming out of its center, sort of like a Taoist symbol, and each of them got bigger at her touch. They included things like communication, orientation, self-expression, and introspection. She paid for the caddy with her ATM card and felt like a total wanker. Next, she would go get some giant square dark glasses and a medallion that changed color depending on how recently she got laid. God. Still, it was a fun toy. And at this point, she would try anything to make herself feel less claustrophobic and self-absorbed. Although there was something perverse about buying a device that offered a huge introspection wedge in the hope that it would make her more social. That night, Patricia sat in bed and played with her new caddy. It wasn't that different from a standard tablet, except for the guitar pick shape, and the way it insisted on asking demented questions to customize your experience, like, would you rather lose your sense of smell or taste? When was the last time you were glad you stayed up late? There was a checkbox to disable the questions, but everybody said they made it work a million times better, and they tapered off after a day. And sure enough, after a few days, the caddy was steering her oh so gently toward happy accidents and little discoveries. There was that little egg-themed restaurant in Hayes Valley where everybody sat in egg chairs and ate egg dishes, from scotch eggs to Chinese-style egg tarts, and drank cocktails with egg yolks. The whole place was an allergy waiting to happen, but it was also warm and cozy, and there was a faint smell of butter and sugar in the air, making her feel like she was in her grandma's kitchen and 5 years old. The caddy helped Patricia to figure out which bus to take to avoid being late for work, and when one of her Mary Janes broke a strap, the caddy steered her to a hole-in-the-wall place that fixed it on the spot. Within a few days, Patricia had a low-level awareness of what a dozen or so people in her life were up to at any given moment, without feeling overwhelmed. She managed to grab lunch with a very apologetic tailor and make time for an ice cream conference with Dee Dee and Racheline. Then something weird happened. Right around the time Patricia had gotten used to the caddy and started thinking of it as an extension of her personality rather than an appliance, after about 5 days, in other words, she started running into Lawrence. A lot. At lunch, at dinner, at tea, on the bus, in the park. At first, it didn't seem like a big deal, since San Francisco was a tiny town. But after a couple days, it felt weird. She would see Lawrence, say hi and mumble a few awkward words, and then bail. And then the process would repeat, a couple hours later. She would think he was stalking her, except that she was the least stalkable person ever. The third day, she tried shaking up her routine, going for vegan soul food in the outer sunset, and somehow Lawrence was there too, going to some kind of Musée Mécanique revival. Hey again, he said. He started to say something else, but seemed to think better of it. She was already saying, hey, and turning back to talk to Taylor. She wasn't trying to avoid Lawrence, exactly, but at the same time she wasn't dying to hang out with someone who had promised Kawashima that he would keep her from getting a swelled head. She already had enough people giving her shit for aggrandizement. She didn't need a friend who was sworn to tear her down. Of course, this had been Kawashima's plan all along. If he'd told Patricia she wasn't allowed to hang out with Lawrence anymore, she'd have been pissed and would have hung out with Lawrence anyway. So instead, Kawashima tells Patricia to hang out with Lawrence all she wants, then enlists Lawrence's aid in cutting her down to size, thus ensuring she'll never want to see him again. That she saw through this ploy didn't prevent it from working perfectly. On her break at work, she picked up her caddy and scrawled, "What's the deal with Lawrence?" with her finger. The caddy responded by telling her some facts about Lawrence, including some physics prize he'd won at MIT. She couldn't help feeling like the caddy understood perfectly well what she was asking and was just playing dumb. She decided to leave the caddy at home. And for a whole day, her life was boring again, just missing the bus and not connecting with her friends and not having time to grab dinner in the middle of running errands. The rain started as she was heading home for the night, and she had forgotten her umbrella, and there was no place to buy one. And of course, she had to run 10 blocks to catch the bus, which left just as she got there. She waited another half an hour, under a disintegrating canopy, for the next bus, and when she staggered on board, drenched as a sponge, the only empty seat, was next to Lawrence.
"Oh, shit," Lawrence said. "You are fucking soaked. Jesus, I'm so sorry. That is fucked up."
He gave her his nice cotton hoodie to use as a towel. She tried to say it was cool and he didn't have to do that, but he kept shoving it at her.
"Thanks."
Patricia patted herself with the hoodie as best she could. At least the heat wave finally broke.
"This bus doesn't go to your place, does it? I mean, you have to change buses," Lawrence said.
Patricia admitted that this might be the case.
"Well, I understand if you need to get home right away, but there's a bar up here on the right that has an actual open fireplace, and they serve hot toddies and stuff. We ought to get you warmed up as soon as possible."
The bar had a hunting lodge theme, complete with slabs of wood covering the walls and faux animal heads coming out of one wall that squicked Patricia at first. But they got a primo spot in front of the fireplace, and the scent of mesquite and wood smoke was a rain antidote. The stereo played an album of acoustic covers of Steely Dan, featuring a bluesy female mezzo-soprano, and Patricia guessed it was called Steely Danielle. Lawrence brought Patricia a mug of hot chocolate and a shot of nice whiskey, which she could consume together or separately, her choice. She drank most of the hot chocolate and then sipped the whiskey to burn away the milky sweetness. The whiskey was sharp in the way that really nice cheese is sharp. She started to feel comfortable in her own skin again.
"I suspect I'm being punished for leaving my caddy at home," Patricia confessed.
This wasn't the first time Lawrence had heard people talk about their caddies as if they were jealous gods. He told her about all the odd superstitions, for lack of a better word, that people had about their teardrop-shaped computers. One person might believe his caddy saved his marriage, and then you'd run into someone else whose caddy destroyed her marriage. But she later decided it was for the best. People sold their houses and got rid of their cars because their caddies showed them a simpler way to live. A few people even found God, actual God, thanks to their caddies. People were attached to them in a way that nobody ever had been to their iPhones or Blackberries.
"That's not creepy at all," said Patricia. She wondered if she should just throw it away.
On the one hand, it's finally fulfilling the promise of technology, of making your life easier, Lawrence said. Simpler, or more full of excitement, depending on what you want. On the other hand, people are outsourcing some crucial life stuff to these things.
"I notice you don't have a caddy."
Patricia's whiskey glass was empty. She bought another round for herself and Lawrence.
"I have three at home," Lawrence said. "I jailbroke one, and now it doesn't work quite the same. There's something about the OS that resists any kind of analysis. You can install Wildberry Linux on them, and they work just like any other tablet, but nothing fancy."
They fell into a long silence. The fire crackled, and the Steely Dan cover CD reached its triumphant final track, which was predictably, "Ricky, Don't Lose That Number." Patricia felt like she should say something about why she'd been avoiding Lawrence, in spite of her caddy's attempts to smush them together. She wasn't sure what to say.
"That promise," Lawrence said out of nowhere, "the one that your friend made me agree to. Not the first one, the one where I go mute forever if I blab, but the other one."
"Yeah." Patricia tensed and felt a chill on the inside, in spite of the firelight and whiskey glow.
"It's riddled with loopholes," Lawrence said, "even apart from the fact that there's no penalty for breaking it. I mean, I never should have agreed to it, and I wouldn't have if I'd been less drunk. It's not my job to police someone else's self-esteem, not in any sane world. But in any case, it's a meaningless promise."
"How so?"
"I've been thinking about it a lot, and the wording is so imprecise that it's not even a promise in any real sense.
I'm supposed to keep you from getting an unrealistically high opinion of yourself. But if, say, I happen to believe that you're the coolest person I know, then I'm unlikely to think you're overestimating your own coolness. It's dependent on my own opinion, plus my estimation of what your opinion of yourself is. That's a whole bunch of subjective criteria right there. Add to that the fact that I only said I would do my best, which is yet another subjective judgment. If I made it my life's work to break that promise, I'm not sure I could find a way. Huh. And now Patricia felt dumb. So Lawrence had succeeded in crushing her ego after all. She should have seen that Kawashima was just creating one of his intentionally flimsy traps, where the real trap is that you fool yourself into believing the snare to be robust. But she also felt better. And then the part where Lawrence sort of hinted that he thought she was the coolest person he'd ever met sank in as well, even if it was just a rhetorical supposition. "And you know these people way better than I do," Lawrence said. "But it strikes me that this thing about aggrandizement is a way of controlling you. They don't want you to use your power, except for however they tell you to." At last, the rain stopped, and Patricia had dried out except for her shoes. They headed for two separate bus stops, although their route coincided for 4 blocks. They hugged goodbye. When Patricia got home, she gazed at her caddy while brushing her teeth, like a blank mirror, and it filled her in on everything she'd missed. Before she sank into her bed, she tossed the caddy back in her shoulder bag. Chapter 21. Sometimes Lawrence zoned out and imagined walking on another Earth-like planet. The weird gravity. The different mix of oxygen, carbon, and nitrogen in the air. Types of life that might defy our definitions of plant or animal. More than one moon, maybe more than one sun. His heart could burst, just with the newness of it. Digging bare feet into soil that no human toes had plowed. Under a brazen sky that proclaimed all the things we had thought our limits were merely our prejudices. And then he snapped back to the reality that his team was stuck. No closer to opening up the final frontier than a year earlier. He would come out of his reverie to find another email from Milton, who wanted progress reports that included actual progress. These emails contained phrases like, "Humanity strides along a widening precipice." Some days, Lawrence struggled to motivate himself to go into work, and once there, he couldn't bring himself to leave. When he talked to Serafina about his work, he kept the details vague. As far as Serafina knew, his team was working on a theoretical anti-gravity thing that could yield some practical application years from now, if ever. But he longed to show off the finished product to Serafina and spread his arms wide as the pathway to infinity burst open behind him. That would be the crowning moment of his life. Which is why, when Priya said she wanted to be the first weightless person on Earth, Lawrence scarcely hesitated. Priya had these amazing hands that she gestured with when she talked, and it was like she was making shapes in your brain. Her fingers were long and rippled with indentations, and she wore chunky rings with big fake sapphires, plus pastel acrylic nails. Saugata had been staring at Priya for weeks across the hack-olective, watching her solder, wearing safety goggles that only made her look more elfin. She constructed some kind of wireless-enabled burrowing robot that could hide small objects where you'd never find them without the right PGP key. Lawrence was like, "You should sneak her up here and show her the antigrav and the not-quite-antimatter. She'll be yours forever, man." Anya and Tanea fought against letting Priya inside their headquarters,
on the grounds that she would tell everyone else in the Hacko elective, and there would be drama. The hackerspace had some cool people, but there were also people who still thought it was awesome to build your own 2-second time machine. "We're doing serious research here," said Tanea. "Nothing is a toy. Well, except for Six-Fingered Steve." She gestured at the tiny tap-dancing robot, who heard his name and made jazz hands with too many digits. Disturbing, as always. "This is a top-secret research facility, disguised as a clubhouse," concurred Anya, who was wearing jodhpurs and riding boots, plus a puffy T-shirt with Debbie Harry on it, with a belt around Debbie's neck. Anya had just dyed her hair candy pink. Lawrence and Saugata both looked around the loft, with the exposed ceiling beams and posters for the Gossip and James Bond movies, plus beanbags and a corduroy sofa. The disco ball doubled as a security system. The clubhouse disguise was very cunning indeed. Soon enough, Priya was flexing one long, sparkly finger at Six-Fingered Steve and watching him dance. "His reaction time is impressive," she said, with only a slight Punjabi accent. "I would have given him some kind of central gyro for balance." After a couple hours hanging out and tinkering, Priya was like part of the group, and she swore on all that was unholy not to tell anybody else about their hideaway. Lawrence explained to her about the anti-gravity thing. "The goal is to negate gravity, to change the spin of all the electrons in your body so that your mass is effectively shunted somewhere else." "Like another dimension," Priya said, "because of the theory that gravity is a stronger force in other universes." "Yes," said Tanea. "So you will still be here, but your mass would be elsewhere." "All of this is just a means to an end, though," added Saugata. "We think if we can solve the gravity problem, we can create stable worm..." Anya kicked him, and he coughed and said, "Pie. Worm pie." "Mmm," said Priya. "Worm pie. My favorite." "It's a delicacy," said Lawrence. "Someplace. We don't know where, but we're going to go there and enter a contest once we've perfected our recipe." A couple weeks passed. Everybody got used to having Priya around. Meanwhile, the team finally had some real success with the machine. First a golf ball, then a baseball, then a boiled egg, then a hamster named Ben. They all let slip their surly bonds at the flick of a button, then returned to normal weight at a second button press. In theory, a person could crouch on the glowy white disc with the giant red nozzle aimed at it and be bathed in the full effect of the anti-gravitation rays. But I'd want to do a lot more testing before doing any human subjects experimentation, said Anya.
Can I try it?
Priya said.
I want to be the first weightless person on Earth, so my name can be misspelled in every record book, forever and ever.
Anya started to protest, but then Priya said,
Conventional Newtonian gravitation is so last year.
Everybody giggled. Priya always knew just the right things to say. The others looked at Lawrence, who slowly nodded.
Yes, he said. I think we can make that happen.
An hour later, Lawrence was frantically dialing Patricia, praying that she hadn't left her cell phone at home or turned it off for some witchy festival. She picked up, and he started talking immediately.
Hey, I desperately need your help. We have tampered with forces that people were not meant to fuck around with, and we seem to have pushed Saugata's girlfriend into another plane of existence, where we have no way of locating her or even proving that she still exists, and we've basically exhausted all scientific options, and don't worry, I won't tell the others about your secret. Just please help.
Wait a minute, Patricia said.
Saugata has a girlfriend now?
We didn't account for the extra mass and the correspondingly greater level of attraction in the other universe, said Lawrence, as if that answered her question.
I'll be there in a few, Patricia said. I'm just up the street.
When Patricia got to the cement blockhouse and Lawrence came down to let her in, she barely had time to impress upon him the fact that his friends must not find out about her skills, no matter what.
Sure, sure, said Lawrence. Of course. Soul of discretion. No worries at all. Just please, please, if you can, please help. I will be in your debt forever.
He was climbing the stairs behind her, and as they reached the top step, Patricia turned and practically glared at him.
Never, ever say that to me.
Incandescent.
Say what? The thing about being in my debt. It has a different meaning for me than it does for most people.
Oh. Oh, right. Okay. Well, I will be super grateful. Anyway, it's over here. Saugata, Anya, and Taneya stared at the shining white circle under the big ray gun barrel and didn't acknowledge Patricia's arrival until she was standing next to them.
What's she doing here? Saugata said.
She can help, Lawrence said. I can't explain, but she can help.
What's her area of expertise again?
Anya folded her arms over her unicorn shirt.
Dimensional transcendentalism, said Patricia.
You just stole that from Doctor Who. This isn't a joke. This is serious, Anya said.
Okay, look, Patricia said. Do you guys want your friend back or not?
Everybody nodded, slowly.
Then just stand the fuck back and let me work.
Everybody kept clustering around Patricia and trying to see what she was doing, and Lawrence worried that she was going to put so much energy into obfuscation that she wouldn't be able to reach into the hole in the universe and pull Priya out. Patricia was wearing a strapless red dress that teased you with the sweep of her pale shoulders and a hint of cleavage. As she turned her back to Lawrence and stared into the space over the white circle, he couldn't help noticing the dimples behind her knees and the perfect curves of her calves and ankles. Lawrence still wasn't entirely sure what had happened to Priya. He had no real data. She'd floated, the way Ben and the various objects had. Her sandals had fallen as her feet lifted off, and her bright toenails had wriggled. She'd laughed and clapped her hands and said, "Suck on this, Newton!" Everybody was high-fiving and making upskirting jokes, and then she'd just gone pop. It was sort of a balloon-popping, squelching sound, as if something sucked her into an invisible hole. All that remained were her sandals, one of which was upside down. Lawrence had felt a compulsion to pick them up and place them neatly beside each other next to the beanbag, as if she'd come back for them in a moment. Patricia turned and gestured to Lawrence that she needed some space here. He grabbed Saugata's arm and dragged him toward the exit, beckoning for Anya and Taneya to follow.
"We need to get her some supplies," Lawrence said. "Patricia needs boiling water, dry ice, regular ice, half a dozen jailbroken caddies, and a few other things. Come on, people, let's haul ass."
He hustled them out of there.
"If this doesn't work," said Saugata.
"If you're just wasting our time while Priya is in danger," said Anya.
"We will end you," Taneya concluded.
Lawrence looked back at the steel door, which he'd slammed shut behind them, and inhaled loudly through his teeth. He felt as if he, too, were about to be sucked into a completely unknowable other space.
"Let's hurry up and get those supplies," he said.
He kept adding more and more items to the list, some of which they'd need to purchase at the grocery store or borrow from people in the hackerspace a few blocks away.
"Damn, damn, damn," Saugata kept saying under his breath. "Damn, it's all over. I'm so sorry, Priya."
Anya put her hand on Saugata's shoulder. Lawrence was putting a lot of energy into pretending that the scavenger hunt he was sending his friends on was vital
and time-sensitive. And then he looked down at his phone and saw a text from Patricia. Come back.